Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to the sixth BOA coronavirus special report with my good buddy and now I guess you could say co-host on this wild ride where if you told me 6 weeks ago, I couldn't even imagine where we would be here on April 17th, but we're here, whether we like it or not. And so I say this all the time, but I can't thank him enough for continuing this ride, and we're going to do it again here tonight. Dr. Tyler Cook, John, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thank you. Here we are.
Yes, absolutely. It's gotten really weird this week. I guess we'll start out as we do on the show with the numbers here. We're not going to sugarcoat it, folks, as I say all the time. According to Worldometer, which has become kind of my go-to now, but as I said, there's like three different sites, and they all kind of do the same thing, so it varies relatively. But I use Worldometer because they have a little more – I can get a little more handle on the stats, kind of dig down deeper. But according to Worldometer, there are 709,735 coronavirus cases here in the United States. So, again, when we started the show 6 weeks ago, there were 1,000. And now we're at 709,000. So, staggering. The number of deaths has been – demoralizing, tragic, horrifying. This is just, you know, I couldn't even run out of adjectives to describe this. It's a living nightmare, folks. 37,154 deaths. That's just in the United States. This is the nightmare scenario we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. I'm seeing it just here in Massachusetts. You know, it's funny, we talked about this, I don't know, maybe it was a couple of weeks ago. It seemed like, maybe we had kind of dodged a bullet here in Massachusetts. Well, that's not the case, because now we're third in the country behind New York and New Jersey. And people are, the last few days, it's been like over 100 people dying every day. Today was like 159 people. The obituaries past Sunday in the Boston Globe were 11 pages, and I guarantee you, I imagine it's going to be something like 22 pages, 30 pages, or something like crazy like that this coming Sunday, because it's been like this all week, 150 or so people every day in Massachusetts, and, staggering. Today for New York, they had 1,000 deaths, so this is what we talked about, you know, said on the show. It's like when people are dying by the hundreds every day, what's going to happen? And in a lot of places, that is the case. Other places, it seems like it's on its way there. At the very least, in just about every state I'm looking at here, in the top sort of bracket, if you will, there's dozens or so cases, dozens of deaths. The cases are just counting the cases is becoming almost an onerous task in and of itself, because the number just keeps growing and growing. And I assume we're going to stick with this for a few more weeks, and I guarantee you that at some point in the next couple of weeks, we'll be at 1 million people in America with it. We already think, I think we can all agree there's definitely a million people or so, or much more than that probably, who have this. But we'll get into the testing issue. Testing was kind of the big thing this week. So what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts here on as we start the sixth week of this mad adventure, Tyler?
We're still not clear on what the real numbers are because our testing isn't quite up to the task yet. So what you do is you take a look at those numbers and say, yeah, that's a rough estimate. We also have questions about how many people are asymptomatic, what that ratio is. It will take a while to figure that out as well. But the testing has been a contentious issue from the very beginning, and it's hurt us. The effort has been hampered by the problems with the rollout of the tests, and it will come back to haunt us again when we start talking about releasing some of the restrictions, because we'll need to have a way to sort of figure out, is this okay? Is it working? Or are cases cropping back up? You could argue that we could wait to see how many people show up sick or count deaths, for example. But if you do that, you're way behind the curve again. And I think you had mentioned earlier that if we're not really careful here, we could end up kind of losing what we've won, sacrificed to win. Terms of control, what little control we have. So it's going to be a long walk towards recovery. And there may be setbacks. People have to be prepared for that.
Yeah. It's, I think I saw article a while ago, like when this first kind of started, that showed that this was likely going to go with a huge peak at first, then down, then sort of a series of smaller peaks over the next year and a half. The real issue, as we just talked about, is the testing, which is like crazy because I feel like this was like what we were talking about 6 weeks ago on the first episode. That they need to test more people. They need to test more people. Like, I don't understand. I mean, I understand it's hard to figure out a test and stuff, but, I mean, it's disheartening that they can't seem, in some circles, to grasp the concept of the fact that we need to test as many people as possible. It's driving me nuts.
What's hurt is everything that can go wrong has gone wrong in kind of a cascade. That we've had problems with the actual administration of the test, but also getting the supplies for the test, the special background swabs and whatnot. But where it's really come back to haunt us again double is the slow time to get results. When you're doing this as a diagnostic, as a mitigation strategy, discover, isolate, treat, which is what our primary focus has been. We've been so slow and basically unable to sort of keep up with demand. That coupled with the equipment, the personal protective equipment shortage, has left a lot of medical personnel to become ill and not be adequately covered. Then, it all cascades. And so you get these series of events that all line up to create kind of a real disaster. It's just unfortunate. All these factors came together to cost people their lives.
Yeah, it's as I said, we've been trying to be upbeat the last couple of weeks, but coming into tonight's show, I got to tell you folks, I'm bummed. I'm really concerned, I guess, because it felt like. It felt for like a few brief moments that we were all, regardless of what side of this political spectrum you were on, we're on the same page here. And it seemed like, okay, we're kind of uniting to fight this thing. And now it seems like everybody's gone back to their little camps almost maybe as an outgrowth of what we talked about last week, where it seems like people are, now they've gotten used to the situation that we're in. They've processed what's happening, and now they've decamped to their respective sides, when what we really need now is a unified front in the face of this thing. This is a long, I just don't think people understand. This is, like you said, it's a long process here. And the thought that we're going to magically have this solved in 2 weeks is just foolish. It's absolutely foolish and dangerous. It's dangerous.
You know, the thing that we have to keep in mind is not to necessarily, get concerned that we have differences of opinion. The major problem will be is if, and I don't know that it will happen, is if the pressures become so great that we don't rely on Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx to say, yeah, this is okay or reasonably okay. No, what will have to happen is that the decisions will end up being political decisions. The scientists will be sort of in a supporting role, basically the as advisor. But the solution and the mechanisms that we choose are not necessarily going to be a medically or scientifically perfect, if there is such a thing, solution. And so we may have to tolerate some risk. We've got to get things going again as we can safely. And so that finding that sweet spot, that middle ground, that's going to be a pretty intense political process. And it's going to be different in different parts of the country. There's no doubt about that. That will
absolutely
be an interesting complication itself. You know, maybe the next couple of weeks, some of those things will start to cascade into us, and we'll say, like, yeah, Michigan's not ready to roll yet. And that means, you know, the auto industry can't get going or things like that we hadn't thought of because they can't move parts across. Who knows what will happen? All these things
we never thought
of. So, we're in for a long haul. We're going to have disagreements. That doesn't necessarily mean that, we're going to be assigning right, wrong, and blame. We'll just have to kind of, tolerate some more ambiguity and say, well, this may not be quite exactly the way that we think it should be, but this maybe will work out okay. My worry, honestly, is we might get ahead of the game and try to release too soon and then trouble.
Right. That's the concern of many. And I said this last week. I can understand why there's a lot of people out there who are chomping at the bit to get reopen the country, as they say, and everything. And if you're out of work, I can totally understand why and you don't have that cushion, aside from the $1,200 in Trump bucks, if you even were lucky enough to get it, I can see why people really want to get back to work. They're worried, they're concerned. I totally empathize with those people. And I just worry that if we jump the gun too soon, it's going to hurt them worse than if we had just waited. I don't know. I don't know when a good time is. That's the thing. Nobody knows. You know what I'm saying? We're all gonna have our own opinions. Yeah.
We know that probably by slowing everything down, doing social distancing, that we seem to have achieved some of the goals in terms of not getting our medical systems overwhelmed. If you want to look at it, a system gone to the max, to the extreme. Look at New York. But if we look at other places, we see that some of these things, these measures have helped and will get us to maybe the best spot that we can be in. But your question about when, is it another 2 weeks? Where do we draw the line? All those things, these are going to be very difficult. And one of the interesting things that's happening is the models that have been put out, where they had a range of we'll have 100,000 deaths to 240,000 deaths, depending, and so we may actually not have as dire a circumstance as was first portrayed, And some of the people are now saying, well, that model's no good. A lot of people said that model wasn't very good to begin with. But be that as it may, we are constantly in an adjustment and learning situation. We only have a few real solid facts about coronavirus, and we need to remind ourselves that the models are predicated on assumptions, best bets, what we think is happening. They may or may not actually turn out the way that we had hoped they would in terms of predictive power, but we do know a few things, and one of those things that we know is that the coronavirus is a beast. It's unpredictable. It's a killer. And if you want to see what it can really do, let it off the leash. And I think nobody wants that.
Yeah. Well, it's extremely difficult. I can understand why it would be difficult, just in a sense that the country's so big. And there are certain areas where I can understand why the people living in, say, I don't know, Montana or whatever, they might feel like that they don't need all these restrictions and everything. And I can understand that. And I can see the difficulty in – you can't really come up with a one-size-fits-all solution necessarily for the entire United States.
You're correct. Absolutely correct, yes.
Which is therein lies the challenge, I guess. You know, I think that a more nuanced approach would be key. But then you have people who just, you know, they just want to open it right away. They don't care. And it's like, I don't know. It leaves me very – I'm more concerned than angry. You know what I'm saying? I'm not like – I understand human nature and human feelings and everything. So, to me, I just like to err with a pandemic, I feel it's wise to err on the side of caution rather than roll the dice. Better safe than sorry is kind of my attitude about this.
Well, that's actually kind of fits with the sort of way I was trained and how I think most medical people would react towards the situation. You know, is that we had a set of standards, and one of the first things would be trying to do the best we can in terms of salvaging as many lives as possible. It's going to be interesting. You know, I'll tell you, one of the things that was fascinating to me was a statement I think that was attributed to Dr. Oz, which would be that, well, if we opened up the schools, we'd only lose 2 to 3% of the school children, which is astonishingly unbelievable in terms of coming from a medical professional. That you would say that's okay, that's the trade-off. And so when we get into, you know, numbers games, right now, you know, we're, what are we at, 37,000 and counting. How many are we willing to lose? And that's quite an interesting calculation. So, one problem with the testing is that what we really would like to do, and there will be new tests coming on board that will help us understand antibody prevalence, and then we can figure out what the actual incidence is region by region of the disease, which is going to vary, okay, probably quite markedly. But we have a lot of unknowns, and we need to turn those into a situation where we can establish sort of boundaries or parameters for risk and say, in this area – there's just too much of it creeping around right now. We don't want to open up. But maybe over here in the Bay Area, California, maybe we can give it a try. And they're predicated, in my mind, on the ability to properly surveil and figure out what's going on before you start to see cases show up at the hospital. Because at that point, it's almost too late. You're behind again. So it's going to be difficult. I'm not going to kid you. We are awaiting new antibody tests. There will be lots of technical problems and lots of interesting results. I promise you that, because we're starting to see some of those things trickle in now.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's my. If I had sort of a bailiwick in the early days of this show, it was we need a national lockdown. And now it's, we just need more widespread testing. And that's like, everybody seems to agree with that sentiment. So I mean, it's just frustrating, okay. Man. It's just frustrating.
What I worry about, honestly, Tim, and I don't know that this is the case. I'm just kind of watching, listening to the news, sitting back. But I think that the federal government seems to be reluctant to step up and help with that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm wrong here. And,
that's the impression I
the
guess.
The states, Governor Cuomo anyway, has said we need federal help, a national strategy, and all that certainly would be very, very helpful. But I'm not clear that that is going to come along in the quick time frame that we need now. And I don't know how that will work out. I suspect that what will have to happen is the states are kind of banded together in consortia, common interest, geographic interest consortia, and it could be that they are going to have to come up with the way to develop these tests and pay the companies to get them ready and validate them. And we may have a lot of tools that maybe aren't so great but are hopefully good enough to illuminate what we need to see. But
yeah.
I just don't see how this kind of what appears to be sort of a tug of war between local states and the federal government will play out, and it worries me. So we'll just have to watch.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. There seems to be no unified plan. I know they released a plan yesterday, but you can't release a plan on a Thursday and then call for citizens in three of the states to completely disregard the plan the following day. We need a national unified voice, folks. We need a national unified plan. And if they want to make the national plan, open everything up on May 1st, go for it. I'm not coming out of my fucking house. So we'll see how it works out. I'll see you on June 1st, guys. You know? But to me, the up and down and left and right and can't decide and I'm in charge and now I'm going to let you do it and I'm not responsible and you're responsible and I'm take credit for all this, but this part isn't my fault. Just give me a fucking break. People are dying, okay? We need leadership. Man, not cheerleaders. We need leaders. So I'm really fed up.
Yeah, I guess, honestly, Tim, of course, I can only speak for myself and maybe a few acquaintances. I think the banal plan, as you've outlined it in essential detail, is one that a lot of people will follow. And I believe because they are concerned about, you know, well, wait, is this actually safe? And I'm not sure. And that's why a testing program that would help us understand what the true prevalence is by antibody tests, for example, of the disease, how many people have had it, how fast is it spreading through the community, whatever we can do to get those numbers and reassure ourselves that it's not as bad as we thought, or, you know, we need to be a little cautious for the next few weeks. I just don't see people walking into a vacuum freely. You know, now, the problem will be is that a lot of people will be compelled. If your place of business basically says either show up or get fired, for example, then hopefully they will have arranged things so that you have social distancing, staggered shifts, all those, doing what they can do. But, you know, a lot of people will get swept up and not have options like we do. And it's going to be pretty tough.
It's a dual tragedy in a way, or it could be. I saw somebody, I shared the tweet on Twitter today. You know, I don't think people, some of these folks, it's a double-edged sword. Some people... This is a sort of a rant about the system where it's like people are going to have to go back to work because this is just how the system is built and it's incredibly unfair. They're going to have to go back to work to survive, to get the economy going so the super rich people don't lose any more money. And you've got people who are protesting. They want to end all the restrictions and everything. And as far as the people who are doing that, in a sense, some of them at least are, some of them need to get back to work, and I totally understand that, and I address that in the first part of this sort of rant. But the other part is, like, why, you're not even protesting for anything really to benefit you, in a sense. You're protesting to be allowed to go back to work so you can keep working for the super rich. It's like,
yeah.
Come on, man. This whole system's fucking broken. I mean, it's like, it's maddening. It's absolutely maddening.
It is. It's fascinating in its own strange way. Some of the protests that I saw, I think were on Thursday, and I noticed that a lot of the people were in close proximity to each other without any protective equipment of their own. And I thought, wow, is that reflective of a belief that there's nothing out there? You know, that, wait, this is all a hoax, that it's all overblown. And so let me go back to work and get back to life the way it was. And what I worry about there is those people may be making a really horrible error, and one that we may not be able to take back necessarily. So, you know, you have political identity, political beliefs, whatnot. We all do. And they can vary. I don't know that I'd let it necessarily drive my medical decisions.
Exactly.
Things that could affect, you know, personal health. And so I would urge those people, you know, exercise your right to protest, but be careful. And
I thought
that was very striking.
Yes.
And so in my mind, I'm just wondering, like, you know, is this a cadre of people that have chosen, for whatever reason, not to believe any of the message? And, boy, I hope that doesn't work to their detriment.
I think there's a sizable portion of people in the country who don't believe, who genuinely think this is all hype. And to me, now, look, I don't know anybody who's died from it. If that's the barometer that some people use, that's kind of crazy, because it's like, I don't know anybody that died from AIDS, but plenty of people did, millions of people did. So,
yeah.
At some point, I've never set foot in Australia, but I know it's there.
Good one. But you do know people that have had the disease. And we have a couple at school now who have been diagnosed, and we're hoping for the best. You know, but with a organization as large as ours, with the disease spreading, it's considered widespread in Maricopa County, where we are.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. And so if we keep turning the crank, eventually what will happen is we unfortunately may very well find out that we know people who have passed away. And if you look at the obituaries, we certainly have seen a number of famous people in the New York area who have gotten the disease and died. So it's not quite the same.
Yeah, I mean, we talked to Adam Davies last week, so it's not like we don't it's not like I haven't met anyone who has had it. And that was kind of the point of bringing him on, to sort of put a human face, in a sense, to this for anyone. I highly doubt anyone who's listening to us after 6 weeks thinks that you and I are, you know, the medical equivalent of flat earthers here. So, I mean, this is real, folks. This is fucking real. I don't know what else to tell you.
It could, we've been through this before, that if we just let the brakes off, we could end up seeing what a real true pandemic killer could do. But I think that, remember, we're still kind of in the early phase of the first wave, and we hope first and only wave. The accounting is not done yet. And as we talked about last week, we're only starting to get a handle on the true scope of the deaths, because we've had so many people die who don't really fit the formal diagnosis of the COVID person. They don't have a formal diagnosis. But I think that with time, we'll figure out that, it's highly probable. So that, you know, even the deaths are not exactly ironclad.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I talked to my friend Josh Cutchin about this over the phone a couple days ago, and he made a great analogy in a sense, where he likened to what we're going through right now to the fog of war, where we just don't, there's so many unknowns right now that I can understand almost everybody's perspective on this, which is, I just wish everybody else had that same attitude. I mean, I'm frustrated by some people's perspective on it, but I can kind of understand for the most part. I can put myself in their shoes and understand what they're going through and what they're grappling with right now. Too many people are my way or the highway types, and we need more listening.
Yes, but I think, you know, Cutchin's idea of being basically kind of at sea as to what's going on is something that we all need to keep in the back of our mind, because remember, even the scientific consensus about what's likely or probable or how this agent will act has, in fact, evolved, which leads to a great deal of frustration. You know, well, they don't know what they're talking about. Yeah, there's an element to that, and we have to understand, you know, first no mass, now mass. As we learn, will we do better? And the same thing is true with treatment. You know, we're figuring out what the heck is going on. And so there are going to be things that we do that they didn't do before. And it's just the basis of learning, unfortunately, the hard way. But this is something where when we start arguing about it's got to be this way or the highway, we have to understand that we don't exactly know where our feet are yet.
Right.
So we're not quite sure what a step forward really will entail.
Right. We don't even know if we're all on the highway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's frustrating. I'm trying not to be too pessimistic, negative. I'm afraid the six week long time listeners are probably like, oh man, this is a bummer of an episode. But that's kind of just where we're at right now, folks. I mean, I kind of said this to you a couple weeks ago. It's like, well, I'm worried about what people are going to be like when people are dying by the hundreds. People are going to start cracking up. That's what I said on the show a couple of weeks ago. And when you see some of those people standing in front of the Capitol building in Michigan, how much more evidence? People are cracking up. People are cracking up. And I think a big thing was, I said last week, feels like we're kind of settling into some kind of normalcy in this, or at least people are getting their footing. And I think, I don't know, I'm sure you saw the article. It kind of, I think people are just getting worried. They're kind of coming to the realization, whether they want to admit it or not, that this is a long-term problem. And there was an article that went around, and it was kind of misquoted in a lot of ways, but it was said something like, we may have to, the headline was like, social distancing may last into 2022. But if you really read the article, it was like, the scientist said something along the lines that there could be periodic periods of social distancing through 2022. Not that we're going to have to live like this for the next 2 years, but people, that statement, that observation or whatever went viral. I saw it like everywhere, and people really kind of freaked out. And I can understand why if you can't be bothered to read the article. Because nobody wants to live like this for 2 years. Believe me, folks.
Yeah.
I don't even want to live like this for 2 fucking weeks. But we have to do what we got to do. This is kind of the – therein lies the rub. And if we put the work in now, it'll pay off down the line. If they said – they can't say this because they don't know. But if they said, if nobody leaves their house until June 1st, this thing will be – it'll be gone. It'll be gone by Christmas. You know, we won't – it'll completely eradicate this thing. Then everybody can get on board. But nobody – we can't tell the future. We don't know what's going to happen. So I think people, they don't necessarily have faith in the process, per se. And then they hear shit like, oh, it's going to last till 2022, and they lose their minds. Rightfully so. But you got to read the article.
You got to read the article, but you also have to understand that when that is put out there, it may not necessarily mean full-scale total lockdown. It may mean some things that we've gotten used to, like large group events, sporting events, concerts, traveling to meetings, for example. Those things may be really much more limited than we have ever had in the past, and that may continue for a while. You know, one of the very interesting things is, depending on how we come out of this and how other parts of the world come out of it, I could see very easily where countries in Europe basically say, oh, yeah, you're from the United States, you want to visit, 2-week quarantine.
Yeah.
Or you don't come at all. And so that may be kind of part of the new normal, because I think as China discovered, you get ahead of this, you get it sort of under control, you don't want to import new cases. And as we said before, it's not really controlled until it's under control everywhere. And that's going to be a long haul. So maybe that's what the person was inferring when they talk about 2021, because it's still going to burn through parts of the world and take a while to do that. And unfortunately, we are globalized, or I guess fortunately, because it helps us economically, but globalization has its own costs and its own risks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's troublesome. It's troublesome. We're at a very interesting inflection point, I guess you could say, in this entire process. You know, I think the first, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that we could look at it in a positive light and saying the good news here is that we're now coming out to the point where we can start planning for how we get out of this, you know, how we're going to basically move forward. Obviously, it's not going to be a particularly politically easy process, but at least we're at the stage where we can sort of see that, okay, well, we can start looking forward to what we do next, what comes next. And so we've gotten that far. You know, we're not just trying to figure out how to make 10,000 ventilators overnight, something like that. So progress there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's a good point. Right. We've reached a point now where we have to start talking about what to do about opening up, which is, I guess, that's a good place to be, because 4 weeks ago, we had to lock everything down. So now it's a big, like I said, it kind of comes back to that question of how best to do it. And believe me, if we're sitting here at the end of May, I'll be the first person to admit if I was wrong that I was wrong. I'm like, boy, I was really wrong. It turned out opening up the country on May 1st worked out just fine. So, you know, boy, I was an alarmist on that one. You know, I'd love to. I'd love to be look back and say, boy, I was really an alarmist back in the middle of April when all that was going down. But
no, let's hope that
everything
the way
I've
it
seen
is.
So far.
I mean, it's hard, Tim, because when you talk about preventative action, a lot of times because something didn't happen, it's hard to really assess how valuable that was. You know, after the fact. And so it's not unusual for, you know, sort of look back and go, yeah, okay, that maybe we overdid it. I'm not sure that if I was in charge, my bent would be anything that would maybe cause more lives to be lost. I'd be very loath to do that as best I could. And I suspect that is probably where most of our leaders would be, probably are.
Yeah.
And I hope that facts and actions bear that out, that hope out.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what happens. Let's talk a little bit about the other part, you know, testing. They got to get more tests done. I think everybody seems to agree with that. Now, the other thing that everyone's sort of hanging their hat on, pinning their hopes to, is the vaccine thing. Jim Vujovic, who's a dedicated listener, he's in the chat now. He sent me a question on Wednesday. He's wondering for us to talk about. He's wondering what we can expect from a COVID vaccine when one eventually comes. He says last time he talked to his doctor about a regular flu vaccine, the doctor said that there was a 40% chance that a flu shot would make the flu 10% less severe. that hardly seems worth it, which is why I've never gotten a flu shot, but I'm also not in a high-risk group, although he's pretty much resigned to the fact that he'll be required to get vaccinated at some point because of his job. So he's just wondering if he isn't, if you, Tyler, have any idea what kind of effect can we expect from the coming vaccine? And I want to piggyback on Jim's question, where even though I heard there's like at least a half a dozen, there's got to be more than that even. We know of the one because they were touting it at the press conferences a few weeks ago, but there's got to be like several places that are trying to develop a vaccine. I suppose, I guess, to piggyback on to Jim's question, is that everybody makes it sound like, oh, well, once they get the vaccine, everything's going to be fine. But there's no guarantee they can even come up with a vaccine. I mean, they never came up with a vaccine for HIV. They came up with treatments and stuff like that, but there's still no vaccine for that. So, I know they're completely different diseases, and I don't want to do a false equivalency and compare apples and oranges, but I don't know many viruses. Put it that way. Although I guess Dr. Fauci said they developed a SARS vaccine and then SARS vanished, so they didn't even need it. So I guess the point I was trying to make is there's no guarantee we're going to even get a vaccine, right? But if we do, what can we expect from it? It's sort of a two-part question. Take it away, Tyler.
Well, what they're actually doing is kind of running in parallel several different approaches. I think we mentioned one, Moderna, where they have an RNA system that they'll basically use. It could be, in a lot of ways, very nimble and quick. That was one of the reasons that DARPA actually was supporting that type of research. But if we just think like in the standard method, what you would try to do is come up with a way to induce antibodies to what's referred to as the spike protein, or actually maybe a subset of that called the RBD, receptor binding domain. And that's the kind of the business end of the molecule. And typically, if you can induce antibodies against those spike proteins, the patient is generally protected. This is one of the things that we do against influenza. So the method is one that is sort of traditional. How it will actually be implemented is very interesting. So there are like Moderna's, which is a radically new approach. There are other ideas about maybe taking the receptor binding domain and splicing it into another vaccine sort of backbone. And then I don't know what they'll grow that in. For example, influenza vaccines are largely grown in embryonated chicken eggs, of all things. But anyway, I think that there's a strong possibility that we will have a number of vaccine candidates to test. They have to be tested. And the reason is that sometimes not only do they not work the way that we want, they're actually a little dangerous. We've had, if you're familiar or some of the listeners are familiar with dengue virus, sometimes a disease called breakbone fever. There mm-hmm. is, in fact, a vaccine that came out for that, and then it was realized that it did what people were fearful it would do, is that it made antibodies that would tend to bind but not fully neutralize different serotypes of the virus, which leads to another condition known as dengue hemorrhagic fever, which is a much more severe and dangerous form of the disease. And we've had little quirks like that before. The first vaccine against measles failed. Just a thing that nobody thought about. You grew up the antigen and you put it in to the patient and you induced antibodies, and lo and behold, those antibodies, because of the quirk of how we did it, bound but did not neutralize. And when the patients actually got infected with the real deal, it looked like
worse.
They had Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It's called atypical measles. So we can cause all kinds of problems. The testing protocols are going to be time-consuming, but the first thing we have to understand is, does it have efficacy? And so not every vaccine candidate necessarily succeeds in knocking out the infectivity of the virus. We can do that. We can figure that out pretty quickly through a couple of assays, one called PRNT, which is just looking at how the virus behaves in tissue culture. But we have a long road ahead of us for testing. The other thing that to keep in mind is if we get a good candidate and it looks like it induces solid immunity, we don't exactly know how long that will last. Flu
right.
only lasts about a year, and it doesn't really matter because the damn virus changes all the time. So it's not like
right.
measles where you can have a lifetime immunity. This particular agent, a lot of people think it's going to be on the slippery side. And so it might be a little bit more like the pneumococcus vaccines, which are for bacteria, but same idea is that you'll get them, and then you might have to have a booster every 5-10 years, something like that. Or tetanus toxin, for example, every 10 years. You have to remind the body what to look out for. And we're hoping then that the virus itself doesn't change a whole lot. But again, this is something we're going to learn kind of the hard way. And then the final factor is when is it going to come out? How will we do it mass producing it? And how will we ensure that we get a good quality product to just in the U.S., 300+ million people, get everybody protected? That itself is a nightmarish logistical problem. And one that we should not underestimate. So we may see a phased rollout, high-risk populations first. Those things will have to be determined on the basis of medical, I guess, professionals will have to get together. There's a group called ACIP, and they will make recommendations for the use of vaccines and who should get them and when they should be applied. And I'm sure that group will be called upon to figure out how we administer this. So anyway, that's for Jim. There's a long sort of road ahead, and people are working as fast as they can. But as Dr. Fauci pointed out, there are no half measures in medicine. We have to be darn sure that when we shoot something into a person, it's not going to harm them, and there's always an element of risk, and it's going to do something good for them. And this
right.
is going to take time. So we're hopeful, but again, the cold viruses, the cold coronaviruses and rhinoviruses, they're slippery. And we know that we don't develop or hold solid immunity for a long time. Nonetheless, we can be optimistic that if we can get something that will render us immune and get enough people involved with it, even if our vaccine is imperfect, it will still be very, very helpful. And we can change the dynamic from a situation where nobody's got immunity and the virus just does what it wants to something where maybe it just doesn't work as well anymore. And maybe it is a
right.
lot more akin to seasonal flu. So we've got a lot of reasons to hope. We have a lot of things going on in parallel. I firmly believe that we'll see something reasonably good and effective in record time. But don't forget, scale up and distribution is also going to have to factor in there. So it won't be – we may have a vaccine in a year in a sense, but we really won't have a vaccine for most of us for a good deal longer than that, in my opinion. And I hope, just like we said earlier, hope I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, well, I'm like the furthest thing from an anti-vaxxer you can imagine. But even I'm of the opinion, just based on how poorly this entire – situation has developed and been dealt with, that if they went on TV tomorrow and they were like, oh, we got the vaccine, it's almost like what I was saying earlier. I think I'm just going to sit back and wait until we know for sure. I'm not going to be the first in line to get the vaccine. Let me put it that way. And
I'll
be interested to see who is, I guess. And like I said, I'm the furthest thing from an anti-vaxxer, but this whole thing has been so mysterious and peculiar and just weird. And it's sort of like I talked to you about before with the senior hours at the grocery store. It was like, oh, should I let my mom do that? Because what if it turns out in 3 weeks they're going to go, oh, no, that was a terrible mistake.
yeah.
You know, who knows? So far it seems like – it seems like it worked out all right, but then again, I mean, these old, I don't know what you call them, retirement homes, old age homes, they're being decimated by this. And that's,
yes.
That's really, and the stuff that keeps you up at night is when you see that I read Steve Ray sent us a link to one of them today. I don't remember the article, but it was something along the lines of they tested, here it is, universal COVID-19 testing at Boston homeless shelter, 35% infected, 0% with symptoms. It's the symptom,
yeah.
It's the asymptomatic nature of this that I think has compounded the problem and made this whole response
absolutely
so difficult.
Absolutely. It is the worst possible situation. Now, one question that remains to be answered is, if a person is asymptomatic, they will say something funny, pre-symptomatic, and that means a person who is, in fact, in the course of the disease but has yet to actually show symptoms who will become ill. And when you test them, you don't necessarily know the difference. You kind of have to follow these people with time to really figure out who was truly asymptomatic. The $64 million question now is, of the true asymptomatic cases, which appear to be considerable, how many of them are really good at passing the disease? And so is it possible that they are asymptomatic because the virus just doesn't replicate in them very well? So if they cough or sneeze, they're not releasing all that much. These are things that we will slowly figure out only over time. And as we get a
right
handle on that, then we can say, yeah, you know what, asymptomatics aren't really the worry if it works out really well. We really need to concentrate on the people who get ill and isolate those. That's the key. That's how we're going to break this. But again, we don't know. You know, your question about nursing homes,
right,
just to put this into perspective, it is not unusual for a really nasty flu, like the one that we had a couple of years ago, H3N2, to come in and decimate a nursing home. And one reason, this may actually fascinate you, is that even though we know the flu is going to come every winter, we know that for a fact.
Right.
And we vaccinate people against the viruses that we think are going to show up. What we often find is in nursing homes, the attack rates with just the flu, the seasonal flu, can be extremely high, 80% or better. And those are in
yeah
vaccinated patients. So as people age, they lose their ability to respond. And so this is the thing that probably we don't want to talk about right now, but we'll eventually come up with the vaccines, is that for the highest risk population, they may be the ones least able to respond to a vaccine. And so in parallel with the vaccine production and the hope that that gives us, we also will look for things like remdesivir and other antiviral agents that we can apply to hopefully protect the patients that couldn't be protected by ordinary vaccination. So we've got a lot of things, a lot of kettles boiling here, and I have every expectation that eventually something good will happen. Your question, though, about how many people will be in line for the uptake, it's an interesting one. I saw this in 1976, way before you were born. They did swine flu. We thought the swine flu, H1N1, had returned, and it was going to be another pandemic, a horrible pandemic. And so Gerald Ford ordered the national production of the swine flu vaccine and made it available for free for everyone in the U.S. who wanted it. And we all lined up and got our shots, and they suspended the program.
What do you mean they suspended the program?
They suspended the program. They went out, and we had millions of people lined up. And you got your shot, and you went home, and they had a whole bunch of people drop dead.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Shit. Well, that's exactly why I don't want to take it right away. I'll wait.
Well, yeah, it kind of made a dent in the enthusiasm. But what happened was they had to explain that. And the way that people went about it is, I think, actually demographically very true, although kind of hard-hearted, is that a lot of people who needed the vaccine were on the elderly side, and many of them had conditions that they probably were not going to live for a long time anyway, and the stress of going down to wherever and getting the vaccine, that was enough to push some of them over the line. But the other thing that happened, so they suspended the program. By the way, the virus never showed up. We waited and waited, and it never showed up. Unclear why. And that was anywhere in the world. So they made a huge error, which then came back to haunt us in 2009 when we're trying to come up with another pandemic virus vaccine. And you're going, well, yeah, but you guys couldn't call it correctly in 76, so why should we believe you now? The other thing that was interesting is that with the swine flu vaccine that was offered in 76, have you ever heard of Guillain-Barré syndrome?
No.
It's associated oftentimes with vaccine, flu vaccine in particular, but it's a paralysis syndrome where the myelinated peripheral nerves get attacked. It's usually young adults, and it can be very profound. But it can be associated with certain viral infections, influenza being one of them. It's considered fairly rare, but the Guillain-Barré syndrome was induced by the receipt of the vaccine, the swine flu vaccine in 76, was the highest vaccine-induced Guillain-Barré syndrome level ever seen. Nothing
Jeez.
Like it before or after. But what it did is it took up the vaccine about to what we think is the natural level. So that was kind of interesting, kind of scary. Anyway, there's lots of reasons to wonder, you know, how will this really work out? And one of the things that might interest you is that if there's a rare side effect, a 1 in 10,000, we discover those when we do the mass use of the agent, because we can't do big enough scale trials to figure that out before we kind of reduce
right.
it. And that's, we have a program called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. And then as things come in, which can be anything from pain at the site of injection to patient dies, the whole spectrum, they have a clearinghouse to look at that, to figure out if there's a problem and to take action. And if people are injured, there's a vaccine injury compensation board, so that if you get paralyzed by a vaccine, you can get some kind of compensation to help you overcome that injury as best we can. But we do recognize there's a certain element of danger. And more so with a new agent, a new vaccine. Again, we're going to learn new things, like it or not. And one of them may be that it's hard to make a safe vaccine against this guy. I personally don't think that's going to be a problem, but that's an opinion. And then so we'll have to see how that opinion holds up with time.
We'll see. Yeah, the vaccine thing is a tricky issue. It's definitely very tricky.
Yes. And it's scary. It's scary. And if you think, you know, for you and me, we go in and get the shot, that's one thing. But then imagine taking your child there, or a grandchild.
Yeah.
And you know, you're going to have to make that call. And we certainly hope that it works for everyone. But we know that sometimes, like it or not, you could get an infection, a staph infection or a strep infection from the injection. We do everything we can to minimize that, but we can't always control everything.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's, as I said, a lot of people are pinning their hopes on this, and it's uncertain. At some point, it's to circle back sort of to the idea of whether we need to end all this and just open up the economy and everything. There's a part of me that is concerned that we just, as a society, and this is also in large part because of the economic meltdown that's been a part of this. And I understand why people are itching to get back to normal. There is a part of me, and we're seeing this in some media circles, where there's just this push, like you said with Dr. Oz, saying like, oh, well, to only 2-3% of the children, did he say they would die, or that they would get the disease?
No, that's dead.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know.
There is
that's
a part of me that, yeah, there's just a part of me that that fears that as a society we're not equipped financially with the social safety nets, with the personal, resolve to endure, a certain amount much more lockdown, and that we're somehow going to just say, all right, some of us may be forced into going along for the ride, but there's going to be just this collective, fuck it, let's go for the herd immunity, what happens, happens. That's kind of my concern as I see this debate playing out, that it's going to eventually be, we can't do this anymore, so the alternative is to swing the thing in the wildly in the other direction, which to me is madness, but I have that concern. Because there's certainly people who are saying this. I'm not a wild-eyed conspiracy theorist. This is a perspective taken by many people in the media who say, let's just roll the dice and see what happens. So what if 2 to 3% of the school children die? It's as the gruesome old saying goes, one death is a tragedy, 1,000 is a statistic. There's a certain gruesomeness to that thinking that's sort of underlying a lot of this.
You could, go ahead and obviously a lot of people are proposing that as the route, and you could say there's really nothing that we can do, that eventually the virus will go through the community. But I think honestly, that's kind of the pessimistic approach, that I have absolutely no doubt that we will in fact have potent direct acting antivirals available against this agent in the near term, and that we'll have vaccine several candidates in the near term. And what we need to do is in the interim manage this so that we can spare the largest number of lives possible. And that would be, trying to maintain social distancing where we can't. And as long as we can get by with that, we may have to find out what the number is, what the toleration level is for practical reasons. But I would say that, we really have reason to believe that we can get ahead of this guy. And so to do, I think there's one point. What I was reading was Great Britain was basically going to say, just get it over with, can't stop it anyway. I don't think that's worked out so well for them. And thought that I had seen that, was it Sweden, that kind of was resisting doing anything much more than closing schools, and they're clearly seeing a surge. But the Netherlands, I haven't heard about the Netherlands. I thought that they were kind of also an intermediate case, and that seems to be still holding for them. But anyway, herd immunity may come, but we don't need to necessarily hasten it, because that could be very costly. And that's
right.
What I would say is, don't run out there. Don't rush out there. You don't necessarily have to do that. Hold back, try to be patient. And we may find that we can't do it, and we can't hold back long enough. But I would say, as long as we have a chance, give that a go before you just say, okay, the hell with it. Because I think that's going to be the least effective in terms of sparing human life that you can imagine. So I would say we haven't seen what this beast can do. You want to see what it can do? Let it roll.
Yeah.
I think people are going to be really sorry.
We got to spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?